This is James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist, bringing you another talk from the European Small Talk Users Group meeting held in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, in August of 2008. Elliot Miranda at ESOG 2008 talking about his COG VM project for Squeak.
Another reason for coming up with QNAME is, you know, I've got to sell this to you guys, to get people involved. Let's get the marketing out of the way first, so I don't have to put too much fire up your nose. So, what's COG? Well, the first thing about COG is, of course, it's a logo. So, found this the other day, was trying to find out, you know, what's my image going to be for COG. And superb. You've seen the one with the single gear and the three equally sized gears. That's easy. But, you know, apparently, nobody can find an exact solution, because this is the guesswork to find the four ratios. So, I was thinking, okay, I know exactly what I want. I want that in 3D with kind of perspective and a kind of a metallic look. And what I want is the big thing to be a C and the little thing in the middle to be an O and then the other to be a G. And I was thinking, this is going to take forever. I don't know anything about 3D. And I was chatting with my friend Dan Lanabas, and Dan was my colleague in the first time at the Park Place, and he has this fantastic blog and has been doing 3D stuff for a long time. And he sent me an email with the thing that Jonathan Lombardi had done, which is kind of a croquet ball with a cog around it superimposed on Rodin's Thinker. And it's cute, but it's, you know, not my thing. And Dan said, is this what you want? I said, no, actually what I want is, and I sent him the loom gears. He said, I'll do it. So the other thing that it is it's a blog, which is great. I'm really quite enamored with the blog, the ability to post well-published, well-formatted text and to get people's responses. So this is the first time in my life I've been able to do a project and document it while I've gone along. And over the last month, I've been working on the innards of the VM, and I haven't kept up with the blog post, but I'm going to make a better effort. And I think that the blog is a fantastic way of doing it, so that's great. But it's seriously, this is hopefully community organized draft. I'd like this, you know, as many contributions and as many people who are interested in VM technology to come and get involved as possible. There are lots of things to do, like backends on different platforms, and while I have a pretty well-defined set of steps for the first implementations, that doesn't mean that there's not lots of work and room for doing some other things. So, okay, what's called the technology? That's the biggest OPEC I've ever heard. It's a series of evolutions to the Squeak VM. It's going to have some new bytecode sets. There'll be at least a couple of object representations. And there will be new execution technology. But I'm trying to do the simplest thing that could possibly work and keep it simple. I'm also trying to evolve within the context of the current Squeak. I don't want this to be disruptive technology at all to the Squeak community. I don't want it to be a replacement to the interpreter, the small machines. I like the FastVM and an interpreter to be able to coexist. And so I'm not changing the compiler. I'm not trying to push aside the existing VM. I'm trying to keep various elements the same, like the image format, etc. But I have some targets, and the most important targets speed-wise are an HPS-style fast chip. HPS is the highly portable small talk core. His new speed is small talk, which is the visual works via. And after that, I want to do a self-style adaptive optimizer, which targets all floating point performance. There are other things to do, which is to integrate with Hydra, which is Igor Stasenko's approach to multi-core, which is to have multiple squeak images running in separate threads with good inter-process communication as a workaround for using multi-core, which I think is good. And is completely orthogonal to my VM, so I should be able to have cog VMs in Hydra. And I'm also concerned that Craig Latta's work with small images, I play well with that. So, fast, quick. That's a fast car. That's a quick car. That's like twice the power, almost three times the power to weight, twice the speed to 60, but round the track is 25% faster, which is interesting because it's kind of, on paper, it's three times as fast, or it's two times as fast, but in real work, you only get 25% faster actual performance. It's kind of much the way it is with real benchmarks. You get some benchmark, you make something faster, but when you apply it to some real problem, you don't get that level of benefit. The program actually has to do real work, and you're only optimizing the overheads. But, you know, hence, fast for HPS and quick for self. So, there are some prerequisites. You need closures, because these affect the way that you can represent the stack inside the machine and have an internal stack organization. And then if you want to do self, you need inline caches, monomorphic inline caches, to get your type information. So that might be a mountain, but I've got to find some way of breaking it down into some small steps. So Andreas has said to me, why not do a VM which is halfway along to the fast VM? And so that's the kind of direction. So what I've done so far is to implement closures within the current squeak, which is a very simple extension, just adds a few new bytecodes. And that has involved a few changes to the front end and replacing the back end. It's been very easy because the current squeak compiler already supports ANSI syntax for blocks. And the compiler hasn't changed from when I first worked on it with Brouhaha. It's really nice, it's the same structure. Very familiar. And of course, not writing a whole new compiler is a lot less work. And one of the fun things that happened is actually when you do closures, you don't need block context. You have one context class. So that's actually finished now. And if you go to my blog and the downloads, you can get the bootstrap for Croquet 1 and Squeak 3.9, and somebody may be working on Squeak 3.10. And as of last week, we deployed it internally at Quack, and so it will probably become our production environment in September. So the next step is to break down getting a VisualWorks style JIT in place. And the crucial thing to do is to be able to map activations to stack records. So if you have a look in the classic inject into, this guy gets modified in the execution of this block, and this guy is declared here. So if you do a naive implementation, this assignment needs a special bytecode to reach out of this block and go down the static chain until you get to the home context and access to the temporary there. And the problem with that is that, you know, this is small talk, you don't know who could grab hold of reference to this. So next could outlive the execution of the inject into. So you get into all sorts of problems if next lives there, that whenever you exit this, you have to make sure that the next value is accessible to this block and still up to next. So this gets in the way of a clean mapping of activations to stack frames in the VM. And so the standard transformation, which I did first in VisualWorks, which is from RISC implementations, is to put all such shared temps, like next, in their own heap allocated cell. So for each scope level, you define some heap cells to store as many variables as you need. In this case, we only need one for next. And then we store the value in this array. So here we assign to next, and here we're assigned to temp vector. And then when we do this block, we access the temp vector to extract the value here and to put it back. So now what we've done is arrange that temp vector is copied by this block, but it's not modified by this block. Here, next is modified by this block. So now this block only copies all external values. So it copies binary block, and it copies temp vector. So when you create this block, you can literally copy those values, and you can use copies local to this block. And now this block is absolutely independent of the enclosing activation. It holds onto this array. Both activations can share the array, but once this guy has been returned from, this block still refers to temp vector independently. And so that transformation allows you to map activations to stack frames very easily. So that's the point of the closure optimization. So to complete it, you kind of you need a block closure which holds on to some outer context, because you need the outer context chain for non-local return. And it's very like block context. It has the array of values that it copies from its outer scopes. And then you need new primitives to evaluate these block closures. And I don't know if you can see that, but this is receiver map, which was an old variable in method context, which has been unused forever. It was supposed to be for multiple inheritance that is not used. So I've used it, and it's now closure or nil. So when you have a block activation, closure or nil is not nil. It holds on to the block closure. And the block closure's out of context, points to the next, and so on, chaining through closure or nil and out of context, closure or nil and out of context, until you get to the home context. So you don't actually need block context anymore. So when you evaluate a block closure, you get a new method context whose closure or nil is set to the block closure. So it was very simple to do. And so you need five new bytecodes. You need to create one of those arrays. You need to create a closure. It's very similar to creating a block. Slightly different. And then three to store and fetch from those vectors.
What is a pulse array? What is a pulse array?
So calls array, oh yeah, I should say that. This doesn't fit in a single byte because I need a size. So I've got two bytes. So I've got the code that says this is a push new array and the following byte which says how many elements. Well, you don't need 256 elements. It's too many. So 128 elements is great. So what do you do with the other 128 elements? You have a push calls array. So what that does is create a new array and pop n elements off the stack to populate the array. And so that does brace constructs much faster than the conventional one and more compact. So this is two opcodes in one bytecode. It's kind of a difficult thing to do, but that's what it is. So this one creates an empty array, and this one creates an initialized array. literally, whatever you put on the stack, those items now become the element of the array. So, and then the only other change you have to make to do closures is that you have to modify the return bytecodes to check if closure or nil is not nil, and if closure or nil is not nil, then you return from the home context, you walk that static check. So, closures took about a month, and 6 weeks with debugger work and all that kind of stuff. So, the next step from then to get to the VisualWorks chip is to write all of the stack mapping machinery. Now, the point of the stack mapping machinery is that the VM wants to use stack frames internally so that when you send a message, that compiles down to a call instruction, and it's like a conventional call return in a conventional language. But the image still has this concept of context. It still wants to use the context for everything, for the debugger and seaside and all of that stuff. So you have to arrange that these stack frames are things that can have context as proxies to them. And that's quite complicated. Things like terminate to, which walks an arbitrary number of contexts and nils out intervening contexts. Right? When you map that out onto stacks, where each stack is some number of stack frames, and you don't want to waste time looking at intervening pages because they can just be thrown away and stuff, it gets hairy. So Andreas said, why don't we do an interpreter which has the same stack organization as the FAST chip? So that's what I'm working on now, and that's kind of done. For real sweet VM weenies, one of the things that I had to do was get rid of this evilness. The sweet GC, when you allocate an object, if it runs out of space, the allocation code will run the garbage collector. So if you're a client in the VM, and you call an allocation, all of your pointers may move. And so there's this real hack, which is you have to push all of your pointers on the stack before you call a new, and then call off afterwards because they may have changed. The one allocation in a million that causes a garbage collection. So it's a horrible evilness. And it's just too complicated in this kind of stack organization, because you may create a context at all sorts of times when you're traversing the stack. And it's way too difficult to maintain that. So I had to streamline the GC a little bit and get rid of this. That was good. So what does a stack frame look like in the stack VM? So it's very close to what the fast chip will have. But the essential difference is that, you know, this is a stack and it grows down. And so at some stage you push a receiver and you push some arguments and then you send a message. And from that point you build a frame. So you push the instruction pointer to save it, and you remember the saved frame and then a method, and then need some flags, and you don't have a context right now, so this field is left to hold the context that's associated with this field. I think it's going to be a proxy for it. And this doesn't have any meaning until this flag is set. Now, in a JIT, you know at compile time where the receiver is, and you know how many arguments you've got at compile time. But in an interpreter, you don't. So it's too expensive to reach down, find out the number of arguments to find the receiver in time. So in the interpreter, there's this duplication that once you've built the frame, you also push the receiver to be necessary in the JIT. And so this is used for accessing instance variables. But to grab an argument, the interpreter actually has to fetch the number of arguments and subtract it from here to find out where an argument is. So unfortunately, in this interpreter, the argument access is actually slower in the interpreter. That's a penny, because argument access is very important. But we gain, because there's no argument copying here. So as you're building up the outgoing parameters for your next send, they become the incoming receiver and arguments for the frame, and there's no copying. And we don't have to create a context on each activation or return. This is really, really close from the organization that we have in the FastJIT. And in any case, maybe the two will coexist, because having an interpreter while you have a JIT means that you don't have to JIT huge methods. You can leave those to the interpreter. There's lots of benefits to keeping the existing interpreter around. So the Slack interpreter is kind of done. I use it for my daily work. And I'm going to do a blog post on its design real soon. And its performance has been underwhelming. You see some benchmarks 10% faster, the occasional benchmark 68% faster, but no real impact on the client experience. You may be a little slower. And it's kind of a mystery because, you know, it's obviously faster. But not at all. So I've just done another horrible hack, which is, you know, this guy. You need one of these guys. This is a PC sampling statistical profiler, and this is the bytecode interpreter loop for optimizing, for executing Fibonacci. So this is probably the bytecode dispatch loop right here. There's some stuff that we don't know yet. And this tool is too green right now to give me labels. So, but we haven't had a VM profiler in Suite for a long, long time. And this I have great great hopes for. As my grandma used to say, many a mickle makes a muckle. Actually, the full saying is many a little makes a mickle, and many a mickle makes a muckle. You can actually find that in your Apple dictionary, you know, Scottish. I think that in almost all of the VMs that I've worked on, quality of implementation is worth a factor of 2 or 4. But you can take a good algorithm, and you can almost always polish it to another factor or 2. So quality of implementation is very important. And without a tool like this, you're absolutely running blind. You have no idea what's going on. You have to invest in good profile tools. So the FastJIT should be starting on very soon, and hope that in April 2009, there'll be an x86 port. And then, you know, ARM, etc. will follow as people get involved. And the basic thing that you do to map stack bytecodes to register codes is the translator looks like a little interpreter, and it pushes descriptors on a stack that say things like, I'm an instance variable at this offset, or I'm a temporary variable at this offset. But you don't actually generate code for accessing those parameters until you get to an op, which actually does something like a send, at which point you can then consume the artificial arguments that you've got on the stack and generate register code for them. It's a very simple way of mapping the stack to registers. It's very, very fast. You get really good speed by having cell for the last 2 arguments in registers. So things like output never accesses the stack, the receiver and the index and the value to be stored are in registers, so it goes much faster. And it'll have an inline cache with polymorphic inline caches to help speed up sends, and eventually feed type information to the FastJIT. Now, if it's got 2 things that are sort of new, this isn't fantastically new, but it's a good idea, I think. And we'll have a more open translation, as I said, will retain the interpreter. So let me go into those last 2 points. So what's a two-word object header? So a two-word object header is a way of having the same object representation, more or less, in a 64-bit and a 32-bit VM. And if you look at a 64-bit VM, if you were to waste 64 bits on a class, that's great. You have lots of classes, and it's great, but it's really terrible for the inline cache, because the inline cache is for classes. And quiz, how many instructions does it take on a Spark, 64-bit Spark, to synthesize an arbitrary 64-bit literal, which is what you need if you want to synthesize a class. If you want to load a register with a 64-bit class, you have to construct the literal, which is the address of that class. So how many instructions does it take on a Spark?
4.
No. 6. So you form a 32-bit literal with a push high and a low. And then you form another with a set high, sort of low. And then you shift, and then you OR. And so I make that like three 64-bit words to synthesize an arbitrary one. So we go from a 50% overhead to a 66% overhead, if my maths, something like that. It's a mix, it doesn't scale. So when I did the 64-bit visual works, I went for a class indices where there's room for 2 to the 20 classes. And that 20-bit index is what you store in my cache. So in the VM, you don't actually use classes directly in objects. You have an index into a table. So in Squeak, the headers are a bit simpler, and we can probably get away with a 3-byte scheme. So we have a 3-byte class table index with 2 to the 24 classes. And then we'll have exactly the same size identity hash. So an identity hash that goes up to 2 to the 24, so we'll give you an improvement of 12 bits or 14 bits, whatever it is now. So the idea is that you use this as your tag in all of your inline caches and your first level method local caches, and you only dereference this to actually find the class object when your method lookup actually has to go and traverse the class hierarchy, or when you use the class primitive. But at all other times, the VM is just using this index. And it's got some great benefits, because the garbage collector doesn't move it. So you don't have to go over your inline caches in the garbage collector anymore when you do a garbage collection. These indexes are constant. You also don't have to look up these classes. So in a conventional VM, if you want to instantiate an array, you have to go look at some array of known classes and look at the element, and in there is class array. And now you've got the address of the array object that you've put in your new array header. Well, here you don't need to, because array has a known index, so it's just constant. So that's faster to instantiate. And then the nice idea, why is the identity hash the same as the class table index? It's because a class's ID hash is its table index. Right? So now when you want to instantiate a class, you don't have to go look up what its index in the table is, because its identity hash tells you. You have to make sure that classes have a special identity hash primitive, so that when you first ask for the identity hash of a class, it enters it into the table, and you have to maintain the tables and re-array to reclaim these indices and stuff. But it's very nice. And what's really nice about it is that we basically can have the same representation for a 64-bit and a 32-bit VM. So that's nice. And then I'm really Napoleonic about trying to get lots of people to use this. I'll probably fail because I'm too eager or something, but I would love lots of other systems to use this. I didn't talk enough about Newspeak. I was working with Gilad's team at Cadence for 18 months. I did some VM work there and had a fantastic time working with the team. It was great fun. And I know that I want Cog to be a faster VM for Newspeak as well. But Newspeak will have a different microcode. It's a very different language. It will have a different set of trade-offs. So one of the things you want to do is to try and at least make the bit that decodes bytecodes and maps them onto little code generators to generate code for each bytecode to be not a big switch statement as it is in conventional VMs, like it is in HPS, but to be a table function so that you could really make the bytecode set pluggable and just have one header file which defines what's your bytecode set and have a set of generators which are common to different languages. And then the really important thing is to make the object model an abstract data type in the code generator. So whenever the code generator wants to do things like say, I want to dereference an instance variable, it doesn't say, I'm going to do it like this. It says to some object model thing, will you do it for me? Will you generate this code? And then we can have different object representations, plug different object representations into the code generator. So that's what I mean by an open JIT, and I hope that it'll be used for at least focus week, newsfeed, and maybe it'll be tracing JITs, you know, so there may be other candidates. So then, you know, when I was a young kid, I was taught dynamic translator. That's what Peter Porter's is VMs. And now it's called JITs, just-in-time compilers. It doesn't even make sense, right? Where's the team? What's that? Just-in-time translation, just-in TDM, I don't know. But there we are, everybody understands JITs. So one of the things that's cool is that there's a much better term for adaptive optimization, which is speculative inline. But that's what it is, right? You generate some inline code, but you have guards to see whether this inline code is going to work. So you know, I called before my first attempt at getting this going, which failed, aspect-oriented sort of object architecture, and now it's called speculative inline system. That's great. So it's the sister of AOS. So this is the term that the NLVM guys use, and that's great. So the evolution from an HPS-style JIT to an adaptive optimizing JIT is essentially to look at the inline caches and derive type information from them and produce efficient code based on that type information. So you have to get at the pics through some primitives, which is easy because you have these context objects for the image to say what's your state to. And you want to count conditional branches, because these are less frequent than sayings. And if you the point of counting is to identify what's the frequently executed part of code and when these counts trip, you invoke an image level optimizer to generate better code. And if you maintain counts for both sides of a conditional branch, then you get basic block frequency, you know, which way you've gone down each arm. And you do everything in an image level optimizer. So the image level optimizer sees bytecoding methods decorated with type information from PICs represented as, say, arrays, and generates a new bytecode set with faster operations in it. So that's a small talk program that I can absolutely attest, having done the stack VM in Squeak, what a great pleasure it was to write the VM in Solta. I hate Slang. Slang is disgusting, but the small talk model of the VM is superb, and that was really great to get going. So I have wrestled with Slang a bit to try and get it better. So the image level optimizer needs to target some set that enables it to generate faster code. So you extend the VM with some primitive bytecodes, which basically code for operations that would generate very small numbers of instructions from. So one would be just add the top two things on the stack. Don't worry about them being small integers. I guarantee that they're small integers. And don't worry about them overflowing. I guarantee that they're overflowing. So that translates to an add instruction instead of the tag checking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And things like an inbound, assume that the app is inbounds and it's to a pointer object, and the small integers index is a small integer. So that's how you do it at the image level, and you have a portable optimizer. And a nice separation between the optimizer and the back end. And a small talk program, which means you can modify it on the fly. And because the image is in charge of maintaining optimized methods, you can save the image hop. You don't have to wait for the system to eat every time you start it. And when you do that kind of thing, you're generating much bigger basic blocks between sets. So at this point, you might actually benefit from interfacing with the low-level virtual machine, which has an aggressive optimizer, but a large footprint, and is quite slow. It wouldn't work with FastJIT because the space between basic blocks is so small that there isn't really any an opportunity for it to optimize. Once you get onto the adaptive approach where you've produced much larger sequences of optimized code, then it could be worse. And it was nice to meet one of the guys at Apple behind at LLVM recently and have this discussion, and he agreed. So that's the right way around to do it, so that's good.
LVM part
that
should put the ability to run faster.
Say that again.
LVM is a smart
part. Right, and I'm still not convinced that if the separation isn't done right, that you can't get the code quality. But we'll see. I'm not playing with it, so I don't know. I have to play with it first. So the real target, I think, for the FastJet is good for 3D port for Croquet. It's a 3D graphics application that does a lot of floating point. And the idea is to have some computational model where you've got a byte data stack and you've got horrible bytecodes like, take a 64-bit float from somewhere on that stack and multiply it by another and store it somewhere else. Now, if you have that kind of instruction set, the optimizer can target it and can unbox floats, because now floats are raw values on this stack. And the code generator can map that, the portion of the stack that fits directly to the floating point registers. So this should allow you to generate floating point code, which is as good as C form, with caveats. So, When is this going to be? Well, the FastJet is going to be 2009, April, and then there'll be other follow-ons for different platforms. So, 2010, early version, something like that, 2011, but earlier, if you will join in, become members of the Congress. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that talk from ESUG 2008, held in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, in August of 2008. If you did, head on over to syncomsmalltalk.com and check out the podcast area. We have a weekly podcast and lots more content where this came from. You can also send feedback to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can head on over to the Industry Misinterpretations Group on Facebook, the Smalltalkers Group at Ning. You can head on over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. And, of course, you can go to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for us.